Welcome to our paranormal afterlife. This is our paranormal afterlife, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. And you can enjoy the extended version of this episode ad-free, along with over 200 hours of extended episodes on Patreon. This week, I'm talking to Kimberly Clark Sharp about her book, After the Light, What I Discovered on the Other Side of Life That Can Change Your World. And we're also going to talk about her part in the famous Maria's Shoe case. Kimberly had a near-death experience at 22. In 1982, she founded Seattle International Association of Near-Death Studies. Kimberly is an international conference and workshop speaker, a consultant to news and entertainment media, and has been published in many textbooks, journals, and magazines. She worked for 2 decades as a clinical assistant professor at the University of Washington. Hi, Kimberly. Thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Simon, thank you so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while, actually.
So we're going to talk about your background and your experiences, your near-death experience, and you have a book out called After the Light, The Spiritual Path to Purpose, and people can get that on Amazon, I suppose.
Correct. It's like the fourth version of the book. So there's a hardback with a different subtitle, and then a paperback with a different publishing house with that subtitle, and then a book on tape back in the day with another New York publishing house, and now print on demand. But I got paid to do that because the paperback publishing house was purchased and my contract went with it and they had to pay me off for it. So I'm one of the few print-on-demand authors that actually got paid to do it. Didn't have to get paid to do it, but it was just the luck of the draw. But yeah, After the Light is, thank you for bringing it up. I mean, it's a book I'm proud of and it's meat, no fat that I know it's been out enough that, it's a book full of stuff, let's put it that way. But I write the way I talk, so just heads up for listeners. This is how the book will be read.
You had a near-death experience. So how did that start? What happened?
Well, in the United States, in the middle of the country, is a state by the name of Kansas. It's a prairie state, an agricultural state, with really no big cities to speak of. but that's where I'm from. And I was in eastern Kansas with my dad. 1970, I was in college, but I wanted a car. I also needed a driver's license because it had expired. And anyway, so my dad was going to take me and did take me to the Shawnee Mission Department of Motor Vehicles. So everything I share has a place name and people associated with it that, you know, and medical records. Oh, God loves a medical record. And so I got those too. So I'm feeling pretty good about myself, but not at the time. I was not feeling good about myself because I did not know I was going to die that day. But my dad, who was an attorney, so a very good witness to what I'm about to tell you, I need to share actually from his perspective because it does set up the scene and I don't remember it. But off we were to the Department of Motor Vehicles. We were waiting for, you know, my number to come up, which is actually kind of an American joke because that's slang for dying. But I was waiting for my number to come up and remember saying something to my dad about wanting to sit down and there weren't any chairs, blah, blah, blah. From then on, honestly, Simon, I have no memory on the earth plane, so to speak. So according to my dad, my number did come up, haha, and assigned everything appropriately. We were stepping out of the building when he noticed that my complexion was white on white. And then I collapsed into and through his arms. He could not support my weight, but it put me on the sidewalk in front of the building. And there happened to be a uniformed nurse passing by. This was a Saturday morning, so good timing. on that part. And she came running over, determined that I didn't have a pulse, wasn't breathing. Two phone calls were made, one to the local Shawnee Mission Department of Volunteer Firefighters for, you know, portable resuscitation equipment. And then another call was made to Kansas City, Missouri, which is where the largest and really capable ER was. An ambulance would need to come from there. That was going to take a bit of time. The volunteer firefighters arrived first. Again, according to my dad, they had new packaging for a portable ventilator that had two features. One, to ventilate, which is what you want if someone isn't breathing. It had another feature that vacuumed out any objects that might be blocking the airway. There's a name for that if it happens with food. It's called cafe coronary. But it's why we tell our children, don't run with candy in your mouth. You know, it's just, we all get that information. So that mode was to clear an airway so then the ventilation could start with the flick of a switch. But the switch was on to vacuum. That was the default switch for some reason. They applied the seal to my mouth, turned it on. I have so many jokes about this, but it sucked the life out of me. I was drained of life mechanically. Again, according to my father, it was immediately apparent to everybody, to the medics and everything. They'd flicked the switch back on, pushed the air in, but enough of my lungs had apparently come in contact with themselves, so they're sticky suckers, our lungs. And once they come in contact with each other, it usually takes a steady application of ventilated air in an intensive care unit. I mean, that's the ideal setting. I got a big, violent rush of air that my lungs could not support. So the air, though, had to go somewhere, and it actually expanded to my skin, and I inflated like a bit of a bad balloon. That's called epithelial emphysema, and hard to survive. I mean, I don't want to give away the ending of a good book, but I did live. But shh, don't tell anybody. So there I was. The medics worked on me for a while and then turned to my dad and said, I'm sorry, there's nothing more we can do. No one but a physician in the United States can pronounce a death to this day. So there's euphemisms. And I know because I'm actually married to a paramedic. So at that point, a man that my dad, for all the rest of his life, called the Good Samaritan, came out of now a very large crowd of observers, because there's a girl on the sidewalk. She appears to be dead. I mean, it was just, you know, get on down to the DMV. So from the back of this crowd of onlookers came a man swearing a lot, according to my father, pushing the firefighters and everyone aside. And he did what we now know is mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And by the way, not necessary in today's resuscitation efforts. You just need to compress the heart to a faster tune than to staying alive. But that is the song you want in your head should you need to resuscitate someone. He began to do that with mouth to mouth. And then he gave up and turned to my dad and said, I'm not getting a blankety blank blank thing. My father's memory ends there. But it picks up again when the ambulance did arrive finally. Body was thrown into the back of the vehicle. He jumped in. Off we went to the hospital. Something went off in the emergency room, according to my medical records. By the way, I pulled my medical records to write after the light because I wanted to see what, you know, others might be seeing. And my ER records included the phrase, collapse, blah, 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 blah. And then in terms of diagnosis, simple faint, ? Snafu with the ventilator, ? And I thought, wait, what? Death by snafu? I died of a snafu? But apparently so. It was a snafu-related death. So I'm glad I saw it. Again, I lived. The trauma was for my dad as a parent. A position now as a mom I never want to be in myself. But my experience was utterly different, so that's going to, I'm going to lean in and tell you all about it. The first thing I remember is hearing a voice to my left saying, I'm not getting a pulse. I'm not getting a pulse. And I turned to her. I don't remember seeing anything at this time, but I turned to her and said something along the lines of course you're getting a pulse, because otherwise I wouldn't be speaking. I thought it was like, what are you talking about, lady? I was ignored because, in fact, she could not hear me. But honestly, Simon, I really felt just like in speaking with you right now that I was in a conversation with someone who could hear me and respond. That didn't happen. So finally, I just thought, well, I'm out of here. I had enough time to reflect on this experience. And so I'm limited by words. And that's a big warning to your listeners about near-death experiences in general. They're ineffable. There are no words. They're simply are no words. And I've had decades to find them, and I still search. So this is my best ability to tell you that then I found myself in a completely different place. It was warm and it felt comfortable and I could see things. And what I saw was like dense fog. And I knew that I was supposed to be there and that I was waiting for something with the same degree of security as, you know, at the gate of an airport, you know, ready to board my plane, waiting for my section to be called. You know, it was just fine. And I had time to goof around and look at the fog some. And I'm going to interrupt myself, though, to tell you that because of that foggy experience, I became very interested in that. And in the years that have passed, have viewed and collected many, many movies that include this foggy material. But guess what? They're out primarily of World War II. When the world was in such danger, films about fog and the afterlife came out of the United States, United Kingdom, India, Egypt, I mean, Germany. I mean, there are lots of movies that feature that, but none as many as out of England. So I invite your listeners to explore, World War II films out of the UK. They're good. And they have fog in them. So I felt validated eventually. In the meantime, though, I'm back in the fog. I knew I wasn't alone, but I couldn't see who I was with. And again, just a level of, yeah, okay, this is where I'm supposed to be. And then kaboom. Kaboom would be God. Back in no words. God is a simple word with three letters. And I don't mean it in that sense. It's just something we both understand. I'm comfortable saying my creator or love or whatever. But what happened was in the midst of this fog, an impossibly bright light exploded under me. I mean, it was like a power that I have experienced once on Earth, and that was behind Niagara Falls in upstate New York State in the United States, up by Canada. And if you can ever get there and you can actually go behind the waterfall, the power of all that was as close as I've come to the power I experienced. But there's nothing about the light that I can share that would make sense. It was brighter than a million suns. And I have to admit, I have never seen a million suns. So what do I know? But it was like that bright. And it was all love. And it came up, like I said, like a almost like a cone shape all around me and just took away everything except that. And I said, homie, home. Those are words that I felt I spoke. I later learned from my parents that homie home was what I used to say when I was a toddler. I was first born, so things got well recorded. And homie home was what I used to say coming back when I was learning language into our neighborhood. And I'd spot familiar landscapes and go, homie home. And it's one of those cute moments that I don't remember ever hearing about. But in fact, I did say homie home. And that was interesting in and of itself, because that is where I was. And that's where we go. We go home. I don't know how to further explain it. I just know it. So this light spread out in all directions. I had no eyeballs, but I could see with tremendous clarity. And the light not only went out in all directions in a linear fashion, because I could turn and see it, but it was also endlessly layering on itself. And somehow I knew that I was beholding eternity in the linear aspects of this light. This was eternity. It's unfathomable what I'm saying, but yet I understood it in that setting. And then the layers endlessly were dimensions. Now we live in a three-dimensional world. Science has poken away at other dimensions, but this was like endless. The afterlife is complicated, Simon. What can I say? There's a lot going on. So then I got to ask questions. This was not in English. This was in math and music. I have skills in neither math or music. I cannot add, subtract, multiply, or divide. End of story. Music, if I'm singing, I'm asked to lip sync. It's so bad. I have no tonal qualities whatsoever. And yet, here we are, perfect communication. Also, I have learned since then that the part of the brain that understands math and music is the same spot until around age 10. So the conventional wisdom now is expose your children to music before that age. It'll help math skills. And then the brain sorts it out and it goes to different places. But I didn't know that at the time either. But I guess the creator did, because that's how we were communicating. And it was flawless, but in a way I can't say in words. But I did ask questions. Anyone would ask, like, what the heck is going on? and then questions too profound for my age to ask, you know, like, what about pain and suffering? And I don't remember everything I was told, to be honest, but I do remember that one. And basically it was like, well, the fastest track back to source. I mean, under that, the more stress, the more spiritual our attention can become. But that's not to excuse it. It's horrible. And there's, in my opinion, there's no excuse for suffering. I don't like it. Who does, of course? It went on like that. But then I was told not an answer to a question, but that I had to go back. It was no way I could say in math and music, and no way. And I meant it. Why would I go back? I was with God. I mean, it was ecstatic and so much love. And Simon, it felt like the love was just directed at me. Major ego boost, by the way. God loves me more than anyone else, which I now know is a side effect of a near-death experience. It's pretty common, but it feels that special. So why would I leave? So I said, no, basically, yes, no, yes, no. On earth, we have free will. Not on earth, we don't. I was sent back. But of all things, I had actually not passed my driver's test because I could not parallel park my car. Well, my dad's car. If I got within 3 feet, 6 feet of the curb, I was good for go. But the driving instructor said, no, you got to do better than that. Go home and practice, come back. So I just had that event, but I don't remember it because that's, again, the top side, as I call it, I'm blank on. But, and I'm now so distracted by the light. I cannot tell you the amount of love that is available to us, by the way. And that's why I'm currently distracted, because I got pulled into that feeling, but sent back. And then of all things, found myself about as far away from my physical body, which I could see, as I was to the curb from which I had flunked my driving test. And my first thought after the most massive sacred experience imaginable, and for me anyway, was me looking at my physical body and going, I can't even park myself, which was comical upon reflection, but it was, you know, it was true. I was not there. And I could see my body through a bunch of legs and stuff. I don't know what was going on. And I didn't It didn't look like me, but it was. With my eyes, I saw a man I didn't recognize bend over and put his mouth against that mouth. And I went back into my body through him. And going through him, I knew so much about the guy. I understood it was a knee-jerk response on his part. He was a capable person to do this, so I don't know if he was a physician or a medic or what, but then he felt like a fool because I wasn't responding, and what has he gotten into? I had all of this knowledge about him, and then I was back in my own body. That's important for people who are witnessing a resuscitation to know that their experience as bystanders or as healthcare professionals may be shared by the person they're resuscitating, because that was my experience. So I was back in my body, and then what? I was miserable, to be honest. It was horrible. It was really cold and really dark. It was crummy. It was awful. And I wanted out. And so I begged, you know, come get me. Begging works. God showed up again. I was so happy. And so now I'm back, and it's like, okay, I'm going to paraphrase the Almighty. But it's like, all right, you know, stop your whining. I'm here. So there was, I was shown to my right, like a window thing, a portal, a window. And through that was my heaven. And it was beautiful. I could feel the balminess. It was like meadow of long waving grass, and off in the distance trees and all of that. And no place I recognized, but yet I knew it was my heaven. Also, I was aware of the consciousness of every blade of grass, which is also interesting. I think anything alive has a place elsewhere. It's life. Even a blade of grass matters and is part of our existence in some ways that I still don't understand. But anyway, I was off. I was, thank you, and I'm out of here. I was interrupted with, again, we're back to math and music now. And basically I was told, though, well, look at this first before you make that decision, because once you go through, you're not coming back. That was my boundary. No problem. I'm going. But then there was a flash that caught my attention. And I was told that if I chose to live, I would be living my life in this place. And it was where mountains met water. You know, I had eyes on. In Kansas, there is no elevation. It's a flat state. It's an ironing board. It's the flattest state in the country. You can see the most miles from there. Mountains and water aren't happening in the state of Kansas. So it's like, oh, so what do I care? I'm going to heaven. I started again for that window. And then it was another, well, just a moment there. Another flash of light. And I saw, it was like a hallway in an art gallery. It was like photos on the wall with labels I could read in English, my language. And I was told that if I chose to live, these would be people I would be interacting with significantly. And I didn't care again, because I don't know those people, and I'm off to heaven. I mean, it was like no-brainer. Then there was a third flash, and I saw myself, if I chose to live, being of service to others, something I hadn't even thought about doing, really. And I said the word cool. And that apparently was taken as a decision to return to life. And I was sent back, and there's a part of it that I continually forget to this day that I will choose to remember right now, apparently. It was like leaving. It's like an exit sign, but I was told in a voice that sounded female to me that I would remember everything as it would be manifest. I didn't really know what manifest meant. I looked it up. I had to eventually after the scrambling ended, and I was scrambled. But it means obvious. So, you know, what I had experienced would become relevant when it's obvious. And it wasn't obvious when I was resuscitated and did live, obviously. And I set out to find my life. But that was my near-death experience. Thank you for asking.
So you were shown that gallery and all those pictures. Have you met the people? Did you see someone think, holy moly, they were in that picture?
Oh my gosh, thank you for asking. I wish my best friend was here because she's like an hour and a half north of where I'm sitting right now. Yes. In fact, everything that I foresaw, it turned out that what I was having was a life preview, which is very unusual. Life review is what's more common. I was looking ahead at my life, which begs the question, what the heck? Is it already laid out for us? What is time? What are we stepping into? Is it already done? Because in some ways, that explains deja vu to me, that we've already done this. And all those endless dimensions, are we in other dimensions having the same life but differently? I don't know. My brain, such as it is, explodes at all this thought. I'll leave it to you, Simon. But yes, I did move. I did meet the people on the wall. I have had and still have a life of service. But my best friend happened to be the very first image. And it said, best friend. And again, I didn't know who she was. I made my way to Seattle. That alone is a trip, by the way. I had a trippy trip to get from Kansas to Seattle. And it involved becoming a hippie in San Francisco and, you know, gosh, drugs and music in the park turned out to be a really good thing for me. That hippie community was the closest to my near-death experience at that time that I'd met. I loved it. But moved on and wound up in Seattle, which is his own joke. Could I interrupt myself and tell you why it's a joke?
Okay.
I'm interviewing myself now, but I realize. But the joke here is that I love the story of the Wizard of Oz. And I have watched it in its many forms, have read all the books, have most of them, have met the grandfather of the grandson of the author. I am really on that story. And here's why. In the book of the Wizard of Oz, Dorothy, you know, comes from Kansas, winds up in Oz, blah, blah, blah. There's a wizard, click your heels three times to go back. Oh, Toto and I are out of here. For the sake of people who have not seen Wicked 1 or 2, that's the synopsis of Dorothy's point of view. So I am now, I did get a car, I did get my license, and I actually had a hamster named Toto in a bird cage that I strapped into my front seat. Probably didn't even strap, but there, put an ironing board, a trunk of clothes in my car, and off I headed to find my destiny where all my parents were freaking out because why am I leaving home? Family said, oh, let her go. She'll be back in 6 weeks. That was 55 and a half years ago. And my parents, whom I love, I mean, you know, and my family, I mean, nothing wrong there, but I never did go back. So, but the Wizard of Oz angle is that. So here are Toto and I driving out of Kansas in a place called Hays, Kansas. There was actually a tornado, not a big killer, but I needed to take shelter and did. So that was our tornado. Ultimately, I wound up in Seattle, Washington, which then as now, where I still live, is called the Emerald City. So I left Kansas with Toto and wound up in the Emerald City, but a different plot line. I didn't go back to Kansas. I stayed in Oz. And so I have a lot of red shoes now too, but that was part of the joke of getting here. Another joke, and I keep interrupting myself, but another joke is that I didn't really learn to drive well, and I bought a 4-speed because it was cheaper, you know, shift, German car, Volkswagen. Off I go, square back. Good car to have for someone my age, except that I really couldn't get out of third gear into fourth, and I was hitting a highway. And so we're kind of lurching along, and Toto was freaking out because where are we, and why am I rolling around in a little ball in here? Well, it's because of my driving, and I began to rethink my decision to leave and change my mind. I began to get scared and began to cry. and cry a lot. I really was scared, to be honest. But I knew I had to go somewhere. So I was approaching an interstate at that time, was east and west, called Interstate 70, and it required money. It's called a toll road. And I was on approach now out loud, begging God to take me back. I said, I don't want to change. I hate change. This is too much. I hate change. I hate change. I'm whining again. And I'm pulling up to the approach to this toll booth, and there's a big old sign, and it said, change needed, because it was coin operated. And I just thought, what? It would blow my nose some more. And that was my introduction also to the humor that is still a part of my life. There are signs everywhere, I tell you, everywhere. Just look for them if you haven't already found them. The universe can be hysterically funny. And we either laugh or cry, and I do both, to be honest. But there I was, anyway, in the Emerald City. And now everything is opening up for me. To this day, I've never applied for a job. I've been asked to apply, and I've gotten it. Graduate school at the University of Washington, I was asked to apply. On and on. Everything I needed to do to be of service, to fulfill why I was sent back or why God would say I chose to come back, we still argue about that, was because of the service. And over time, I got, you know, academic initials after me from the University of Washington that count. Academia is a good grounding if you're going to do weird stuff like talk about what we now call near-death experiences. I got a job in a trauma center that still serves 1/4 of the landmass of the United States. And I was on intensive care and coronary care, not afraid of death myself and helping people and their loved ones and the staff get through the trauma of almost dying or dying. And I loved it. I don't know why I wound up there other than I was meant to be. Again, I was getting a lot of important credentials.
My book, titled Verified Near-Death Experiences, is out on Amazon. I've gathered accounts where something happened that could be checked, verified in the real world, details seen and heard when a person was, by all medical standards, gone. I wanted to focus only on those cases where there was evidence, not just stories. The book has had over 50 five-star reviews worldwide, this one from the United States. I have read more than 25 books and watched countless videos, and this book still had new stories. I love the fact that it focused on only verifiable experiences. This is an easy read and great for those needing proof. If you're searching for careful documentation, honest accounts, and stories that may just shift your understanding of life and what may follow, I invite you to read Verified Near-Death Experiences. Verified Near-Death Experiences is available on Amazon, on paperback, audiobook, and on Kindle. So when you had your near-death experience, that was in the 70s, before near-death experience was a phrase, before people really knew about that side of things.
Yes, sir. That is so true. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, there was no frame of reference anywhere in Kansas or otherwise. In May 25th, 1970 is when I had my near-death experience. There was nothing. So it felt like I was making it up, but others were making it up better than me. What I was doing, though, I was in what I still call the trenches. And I am to this day. I have never stopped one-on-one working with or trying to help people who have had a near-death experience. It is my life's work at this point. But there were other people who were doing the same thing, specifically Dr. Raymond Moody, who then wrote a book called Life After Life, which I had not read. And it's probably a good thing I hadn't, because I still had no frame of reference. But for me, Simon, to try to remember the experience, in my own words, I even said at one point that I forgot, but I didn't forget the sense of no memory. I just couldn't make sense of it. And my metaphor for that is like my life was a completed jigsaw puzzle. There was the pattern. I had my plans. I was going to marry someone I'd known since the seventh grade, Robert Clark. I hated change so much. I thought, I marry Robert Clark. I don't even have to change the monograms on the towels. I'm still Kim Clark. I mean, I had my life plan. Then the near-death experience, as we now call it, happened. But again, no frame of reference, no map whatsoever. And it's like someone took the jigsaw puzzle and tossed all of the pieces in the air, and they landed in a jumble that made no sense. And I had to then start piecing them together, but with a completely different image than what was on the box when I had originally thought I had completed that puzzle. So no, there was no language. There was nothing. And it might be okay that there wasn't, because a very famous experience, now famous in my mind anyway, happened while I was working at Harborview, before I knew anything about the subject of near-death experiences, which then was coming out. I found a shoe on a ledge of a hospital where I worked, found by a woman who was being resuscitated at the time. And that story has become very well known. Also, attacked from all sides by skeptics, and I'm still standing because it really happened, and nothing can take that away. But that did change everything for me.
That was Maria's shoe, wasn't it? That's the famous case.
Well, yeah, thank you for being, you're so well-informed. Thank you, Simon. I knew I liked you. Yes.
I remember reading, this was 3 or 4 years ago, some skeptic on the internet was saying that this never happened. It said something like, you'll never find the nurses, the doctor, the social worker, they don't exist. And it just, you know, these people sometimes.
People a lot of times. On that subject, last year, I began to get a lot of calls and texts because there was someone who has a well-known podcast in the United States who had a guest on who was being asked about this shoe. And the guest, who I had met, but not in the context of the shoe or anything. It was a Netflix director. There's a Netflix show that's really good, though, by the way, called Surviving Death. Episode 1 is on near-death experiences. And there I am with other luminaries, to be honest. But anyway, I'm in the mix because I still am in the trenches and I'm still leading a group for people who've had a near-death experience, a big group now. Anyway, on this podcast, apparently the person being interviewed was asked about the shoe, and she was, like many people who are asked about the shoe, not getting it right. It's like, I think that was one, you know, like, where was that? There's Chicago, or I'm not sure. Anyway, so here, I have heard about a black shoe, a red shoe, found by a nurse, found by a doctor, on the roof of a hospital, on the roof of another hospital. I'm happy to have the opportunity to share this story, because here's what really happened. It was none of the above. It just happened, and who knew that it was going to explode? But I was at work, minding my own business one day, but part of my work as a social worker on intensive care and coronary care at this humongous medical center called Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. A woman named Maria had been admitted the night before, unconscious, in a cardiac distress, if not outright arrest, and wound up as a direct admit to the coronary care unit. The next day, part of my job was meeting the patients and doing what's called a workup, including a mental health assessment. Comes in handy when one is about to have one's mind blown. And but Maria was of Hispanic origin, specifically Mexico, and she had never been to Seattle before. She lived east of our Cascade Mountains, which are part of that where mountains meet water, where I live now. And we needed a translator which happened. You know, they were translators were all over the place. So I got to know her through a translator, which is a nice person, doing okay. About 3 days after she was admitted, I got Paige to the coronary care unit. And it was because Maria was very agitated. Earlier that day, and something I witnessed myself, was another resuscitation of Maria. She had gone into cardiac arrest while I was working on charts right by the monitor room. And, you know, beep, 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 and then flatlining is Maria. This happens all day in these settings, by the way. This was just a chance to respond. But Harborview is a teaching hospital from the University of Washington. Sorry about my voice. And you get the thundering herds. So it's not a doctor, a nurse, and a respiratory therapist. It's multiples of students and visitors and attendings and respiratory therapists and their students and such. And then the social worker standing in the doorway watching a pretty easy resuscitation. All things considered, she was unconscious when I left. Everything was good. Goodbye. So when I was paged, it was because Marie was alert. They could not find a translator, and her nurse was afraid she was going to flip back into cardiac arrest because she was so agitated. So social worker, come up and fix this. Okay. What I'm going to tell you, Simon, is in my words, because for sake of time. And here's what happened. Maria first said that she found herself, again, these are my words, not hers. She was speaking Spanish, and I was trying to figure it out with my 3 years of high school Espanol. It was not working well, but I could get a lot of it through travel language and pointing, and, you know, it worked out. So she said during her resuscitation, she pointed to a ceiling spot where she had her perspective out of body, and she was looking down on the scene. And then she proceeded to tell me. And I did not believe her. Talk about a skeptic. She was actually talking to the best and worst person. The best person, because I was a good social worker and I did understand. The worst person, I hadn't processed my own near-death experience. I still had not heard of Raymond Moody or his book or anything. So we were all flailing. I did not believe her because the nurses had taught her well about what would happen if she went into cardiac arrest. But where she got me was she talked about paper that was being kicked under the floor that I knew she had not been taught. Back in the day, these were big recordings of cardiac activity that would spill out of a machine. And indeed, it get kicked under the floor and ultimately folded up and studied by the physicians. There's no way she would know that, but I still didn't believe her. Then she said without any sense of motion, she found herself immediately where she was looking next, which was outside of her room above the emergency room entrance, which she then correctly shared with me about it's one way. I still did not believe her because her room was above the emergency room entrance. So I could still tell myself someone in housekeeping pushed her bed by the window so they could clean, which is nonsense. No one is going to disconnect someone in that state so they could clean under the bed. And the beds are like 9 feet tall off the ground anyway. And there happens to be a roof over the emergency room exit, as they are in every hospital in the world. Yeah, because it rains and things happen, and this could be some kind of protection. So she could not see the entrance and told me about the automatic door. Anyway, it's like, yeah, okay, this is like, all right. Still not really fully believing her, but it's interesting. And then she said, and then I found myself in her Espanol outside of the hospital. I don't know where. 3 or 4 stories above the ground, but I saw a shoe, and it was on the ledge, and it was large, and it was dark blue, and there was a white lace that went under the heel, which meant it was like a left shoe, as it turns out. She's telling me all this because she wanted me to go get the shoe. It was like, I'd rather get a beer, but okay. I mean, I'll be honest, I was uncomfortable because this was now sounding so darn familiar. But 7 years had passed almost since my near-death experience without any information about what had happened and why I was there and what I was doing. And why could I see dead people, by the way, on the unit? I mean, life had changed. I knew all that, but I was trying to be la-la-la-la and normal. Ha-ha-ha, that never happened again. Anyway, I did not want to go find the shoe, but I am and was a good social worker, so I went outside of the building, couldn't see squat. I was too close to the building. And so I thought, I'm going to go in. So I went in first to the third floor, good choice, because the third floor housed my own patients. After getting off of coronary care and intensive care, they would go to the third floor as the next stage. So as I went into people's rooms, I knew them all. Like, hi, Bob, how you doing? I'm just going to be looking at your window here. Often the rooms were empty. And also I could see from the hallway, the windows are low. And I could see if there was a tennis shoe, I felt. So, but I started out on the wrong side of the hospital because that's the luck of the Kim, and made my way around though to the west side. Could not see the window bottom ledge because of a cart. No other patients, nothing in there. I went in, stepped around the cart, pushed it aside, looked down at a tennis shoe. And I went into such shock that my mind sped. I thought, okay, my last grasp at skepticism is now. And I thought, well, okay, Maria, could have been a bird landed here. Yeah, that wasn't going to fly. Pun and not intended, but I realized I just made one. There's a building about a half a mile away. It's very tall. They do have an observation deck. She might have had, you know, access to that, which no way. How would she? Anyway, the view was to the west, not looking east where the hospital was. And it was still a half a mile away. It wasn't that close. Maybe she had a telescope or binoculars. My mind was racing, trying to figure this out. And finally, I couldn't figure it out. At the full reality of what was going on just sort of descended upon me. All those puzzle pieces that had been floating in the air and finding a place landed. And so did my forehead against the glass because I almost passed out. The room spun, as they say. I could not support my own body weight. I bonked my forehead against the glass, and it was such a watershed moment that out loud I said, this happened to me. I remember momentarily seeing my breath against the glass. And then I remembered, this happened to me. So I opened the window, grabbed the shoe, went back downstairs to the second floor. I am now on the west side of the third floor of a mammoth building. Maria was on the second floor of the far north end, a whole different addition of the building, actually, not close. And yet she said during her resuscitation, which I myself had witnessed, that she had been floating around. And this shoe, as I looked down, it was dark blue. It was a man's shoe. There was a white lace that came out my side. I had to assume from her perspective outside, eyeballed a shoelace. That was the other end of that shoelace. It didn't matter. It was there. And there was no drama about it other than me. I was then a meanie. So I went back to her room, put the shoe behind my back for one last grasp at what I used to call reality, and said, could you tell me about the inside of the shoe, which I could see? And she said no, because she only saw that outside. Everything she told me, that's all she could see. And then I produced it, and my Spanish came back, and it was, Viva Zapata! It was like this moment. It was the shoe. And it changed everything for everybody. The shoe was like, I've called it the Shroud of Turin of Harborview, because word began to spread by the nursing staff. Maria kept the shoe. This was not a fly-by-night kind of relationship that we had, or with any of my patients, but with Maria, she was in the hospital for 3 weeks. Back then, that's what happened. Good luck now. But back then, yeah, people actually were in the hospital until they were well enough to go home. Go figure. And so Maria was there for a long time. And then in outpatient clinic, she would come back for that for 3 years. I followed her as an outpatient. So she gave me the shoe, though, when she discharged from the hospital. It's somewhere in our garage, I think, at this point, our garage. If you've seen Indiana Jones, the first movie, when the Ark of the Covenant's being pushed into the endless warehouse in Washington, D.C., that's our garage. Lots of unmarked boxes. Is there a shoe out there? To the best of my recollection, when people say, well, produce the shoe and then I'll believe you, it's like, well, clean my garage, have the shoe. No one's taking me up on it. But at this point, it doesn't matter to me. I could whip off the shoe I'm wearing right now and show it in front of a camera or an audience and say, and this is the shoe. But in fact, we have, it's probably American slang, but talk about the horse's mouth. And I am the horse's mouth. This is my personal experience sharing it. Blue shoe, Harborview Medical Center, Seattle, Washington, social worker, legend. Urban legend, as it turns out, though, because now, oh my gosh, it's skeptics. It's like, people, get over yourself. It happened. You know, I found a shoe. Yes, very important information. Not the only time an object has been found by a Seattle Ions-based near-death experience or a Boeing engineer out of body, way up high on a file cabinet, found a missing engineering piece. You know, for aeronautical engineering, and there it was. And he carries that around, you know, when I ask him to give talks, you know, and here it is. But this shoe is the one that became really famous. And it really happened, as I told it.
But was there a moment before that where you came across a patient that was restrained and they said they left their body?
Thank you. You're good, Simon.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you. This is, and I'm enjoying this time with you, I want to add. Yes. So, young social worker, have a good job. I love it. I am seeing things that other people cannot see. I do know what an out-of-body experience is. My after effects remain electrifying. But on a grounded level, I had to get to work and be a grounded social worker. To get to my office required going through the emergency room of this hospital. Again, cannot emphasize the size and importance to regional healthcare that is medical interventions of all kinds. And Harborview is really a good place to get that kind of emergency care. Fine and dandy. But I was going through the emergency room one day, and there was a woman sitting on a gurney in what's called two-point restraints, which is the wrists. And she looked a lot like me, and I like to think cute and young. And so I asked the resident, you know, who was writing up notes, what's her deal? It's kind of a casual off, you know, so what's her thing? And he barely looked up. He goes, oh, she says she's been going in and out of her body, so we're sending her up to psych. Holy moly. Psych was a lockup unit, one floor large, for basically the insane. And that's how she was being perceived. She was being perceived as crazy. I thought I can never talk about my experiences because I didn't believe I was crazy, but I knew it was crazy sounding. And these were crazy experiences I was having. And that shut me down for a long time. I never even followed up to see what happened to her. But it was like, I will never, ever, ever, ever tell. So the value of finding the tennis shoe is that I could at least talk about the tennis shoe. And that led eventually to my own near-death experience and revealing that. And, but when I started the group now called Seattle International Association for Near-Death Studies, at seattleions.org, by the way, there were people coming in who had been institutionalized for this reason, or who had been really disparaged by families, particularly spouses of both genders, marriages take a heavy hit after this experience. There's been very little research in this area, but what has been done looks at could be as high as 50% of marriages just don't work out because people change so much. It's problematic. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yes. In the group, there are also people coming in from churches, again, disparaging. It was rough. People really staggered in to these group meetings. Now, because of the internet and the amount of time and books that have come out by people I now know and love, that one would think would be completely over, but it's not completely over. Near-death experiences continue to be met with some skepticism, acute sensitivity about sharing, and the need to share nonetheless. My point of view about the need for sharing begins with, yeah, okay, helping the near-death experiencer process, but then turning it around so that we all help other people. It's the best thing to do with these experiences. Yeah, they enlarge our awareness. I mean, lots of bells and whistles, and it can be fun. It can be alarming, too. But mainly, what are we going to do with it? Oh, we're going to help people. So that's the assignment I give to everyone I know who's had a near-death experience.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I'd say, again, your book is After the Light, The Spiritual Path to Purpose. And that's out there on Amazon, and people can get that. And yeah, it's been great to talk to you, and maybe we can talk again sometime.
I would enjoy that, because what listeners don't know is that you are unique in my life, Simon. We were going to do this podcast after I'd had foot surgery and unexpectedly had to remain in bed and cancel, like way too close to the date of the podcast. I do programming too. I would have been freaking my freak out. And you remained calm. Thank you. And we rescheduled to today. So I'm grateful for your patience, your attention, your knowledge, your research, and your kindness. I would like to meet you again. Thank you.
Really nice meeting you. This week, I was talking to Kimberly Clark Sharp about her book, After the Light, What I Discovered on the Other Side of Life That Can Change Your World. And we also talked about her part in the famous Maria's Shoe case. A great way to support the podcast is to join Patreon, where you get access to the extended version of this episode. The Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions, and you can sign up for a 7-day free trial. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/ourparanormalafterlife, or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk. The links are in the show notes. And don't forget about my book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences. It's on Amazon. It's sold 2,000 copies, has more than 50 five-star reviews, and you can get it on paperback, audiobook, or Kindle. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.